All right, good afternoon. Nice to see you all. I'm Ed Feinstein. I live in Los Angeles. I visit Eighth Sky once a year. This is my 10th visit, I think we've determined. And as I mentioned last night, I decided to spend the learning time together and sort of tell you about why this is my 10th time here and what I think the significance of this minion is. I want to imagine this morning, or this afternoon, that in 100 synagogues around the country, in 100 different cities around the country, there's a little fella standing up to have his bar mitzvah right about now. Maybe even one right up there. Maybe. And 100 synagogues in 100 towns in America, a little fella in a shiny new suit and shined little shoes with a squeaking, breaking voice of a young adolescent is trying to warble through his Torah reading and his Haftorah. His parents are going to stand there, his mother weeping, his father beaming with pride, talking about what a significant moment this is in your life. This is your moment of adulthood in the Jewish community. And the rabbi giving him a blessing, thanking him for continuing his Jewish learning and informing him that this is his coming of age as a Jewish adult. And the kid looking out over the crowd of his parents and his grandparents and his uncles and aunts and cousins, his little seventh grade friends all giggling and gabbling in the back. And I want to imagine that among the 100 synagogues where this is happening, in the 100 towns across America, there's one kid who in the middle of that experience stops and asks himself, what the hell is going on? What are these people talking about? The kid's going to look out and ask himself, what did the rabbi mean? Coming of age. Coming of age in what? For what purpose? What did my parents mean when they told me they were proud of me? Proud for having accomplished what? What does all this mean? Bar mitzvah, according to the tradition, is a celebration that takes place shortly after the 13th birthday, in which the child is initiated and welcomed into a sitting community of Jews who learn and pray and celebrate and struggle with life together. And so we allow the child to do in the presence of the community, before the community, what only a Jewish adult in such a community can do, to lead the community in prayer and to lead the community in learning. But this kid can see that there is no sitting community of Jews who learn and pray together. His parents don't come to synagogue with any regularity. His grandparents don't come to synagogue with any regularity. The family might own a Jewish Bible, a Jewish book, but there's no sense of learning. There's no prayer life that belongs to this community, to this family. In fact, there really isn't a community here at all. Most of the people sitting in front of him don't know each other. They don't have any contact with each other. They don't struggle and suffer together. They have no connection. What do you mean I'm being initiated into a community when there's no community there? And what do you mean that I'm becoming a Jewish adult? What is the Jewish adult lifestyle or life moment that I'm being welcomed into? There is no compelling culture of Jewish adulthood. The entire synagogue is about teaching children. But much like getting your driver's license, on the day that the state of Illinois or the state of California gives you the license, you throw away the little booklet from the DMV, and you never again have to figure out what's the braking distance at 25 miles an hour. In the same way, the kid knows that now that my bar mitzvah is over, I'll never again have to remember how to read these words of the Torah, or how to chant these prayers. What the hell am I doing here? There are 100 bar mitzvahs going on in 100 synagogues in 100 towns across America. Maybe one kid, that thought occurs to him. Maybe he's able to push away the blindness that comes with all that parental pride and all those checks and bonds and all of those gifts from the parents and all of the cute girls who came from his seventh grade class in their impossibly short skirts. Maybe he's able to push all that away from the party and the the candle lighting ceremony and the cake cutting and the Dr. Pepper 7-Up game that they're going to play, maybe he'll push it all the way and say to himself, what the hell is this? What is this? I said last night that it seems to me that there are two principal ways of reading the Jewish tradition, reading Jewish history, reading the Jewish experience. That there are two controlling narratives. That the controlling narrative that we usually adopt is a narrative of tradition, of continuity. We like to see ourselves as part of an ongoing chain of values and gestures passed on from generation to generation since our beginnings. We want to see a deep kinship, a cultural kinship with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, of Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah. We want to see a kinship with the rabbis of the Talmud, Akiva and Hillel. We want to see a kinship with the rabbis and the teachers and the scholars and sages of the Jewish Middle Ages. We want to see a kinship. We see this ongoing tradition, and we see ourselves as receiving that tradition from our past and passing it on to the future. The notion of transmission, of carrying forward, the dor vador, carrying forward the Jewish faith, the Jewish culture. Bar mitzvah belongs concretely within that narrative. In that narrative, bar mitzvah makes a lot of sense. A community of Jewish adults who have a Jewish way of life have welcomed this child to join them. Have taught the child enough in order to join them, and is now ready to celebrate the fact that that child takes his place within the sitting community of Jews who learn and pray and pass forward to the generations yet to come their wisdom. That narrative fits certain moments in Jewish history. But there's another narrative. It's the narrative of discontinuity. It's a narrative that says that at certain moments in the course of Jewish history, there have been moments. Moments when events, either from outside or inside, forced us to renegotiate the whole Jewish project, to reinterpret the mission of the Jewish people, to re-understand, to reinterpret the project of the Jewish people, to reinterpret the values of being Jewish, to understand in a new way the identity of being Jewish, and to reinvent all the institutions of the Jewish community. Those moments have come at critical moments. The most famous one we'll study in a moment is the destruction of the temple in 70. But there have been other moments when Maimonides taught philosophy, when Hasidism was invented in the 18th century, moments of profound Jewish discontinuity. These moments are fraught with all sorts of tension. They're fraught with tension because it's scary not to know what tomorrow's Judaism is going to look like. It's scary to depart from the comfort of tradition, from the security of knowing that I'm carrying forward what was given to me by my ancestors, from the comfort of tradition. It's deeply scary to take the controls, turn off the autopilot, and start flying the plane. Where am I going to take this thing? Where is it going to go? And God, how am I going to keep it from crashing? It's scary when the autopilot's not on and you're holding the control. It's also amazingly creative. It's a remarkably moment of creativity, which is why, I'll argue a bit later, all the great books of the Jewish tradition came out of moments of discontinuity. Bible, Talmud, Midrash, Zohar, all the great books, Maimonides' philosophy, all the great books came out of moments not of continuity. In moments of continuity, you don't write books. You read them. In moments of discontinuity, you write books. All the great books came out of moments of discontinuity. Now, if those are the two controlling narratives, I suggest that we're living through one of the most profound moments of Jewish discontinuity in the entire experience of Jewish people. That's why that bar mitzvah boy stops in the middle of his ritual and says to himself, what the heck is going on? What does this mean? We are carrying forward a ritual of continuity in a moment of discontinuity. And instead of doing what the moment demands, which is to stop and look at it carefully, to be honest with ourselves of what we have and what we don't have, and to begin an honest process of reinventing and reimagining what could be, what should bar mitzvah be in this moment? What does it mean to have a community? What kind of a community do we have? What kind of community do we want? What are the gestures of that community? What are the needs? What are the values of that community? Instead of asking those questions, which are deeply disconcerting, we would much rather go through slavishly carrying out the gestures of the tradition, pretending we have a tradition, pretending that there really is a community there, pretending that we're really sharing, we're inculcating a kid into that tradition, pretending that any of this means anything. It's only those of us who sit in the back, and maybe that one 10,000th kid who stops in the middle and says, huh? What do you mean? And let me bribe the kid. Kid, here's 100,000 shares. Microsoft, you know, shut up. Here's an Instamatic camera. Well, I don't have those anymore. But here's a digital camera, right? An iPad. You get an iPad, right? So I'm suggesting that this moment of discontinuity that we're living through right now, I suggested last night, it began about 200 years ago with the advent of modernity. That for most Jews, especially those of us who came from Eastern European backgrounds, we crashed into modernity when we came to America at the beginning of the 20th century. From the beginning of the 20th century, we began the process of reinventing a Judaism for America. We began that process. We began to reinvent our institutions. We began to reinterpret our values. We began to restate the mission of the Jewish people. And then, mid-century, there was a crisis, two crises, actually, between the Holocaust and the rebirth of the State of Israel. That was a trauma too great to accept. So what happened at that moment is we decided to put the process on hold. We froze it. Instead, we adopted an ideology of survival. Survival is a great theology to have. It's a great narrative to hold as a holding action. It's like Novocaine. It lets you get through the tooth operation without screaming in agony. And that's what we did from about 1945 till about 1985. And somewhere about 1985, the Novocaine wore off. And young Jews began saying, you know something, Mom, Dad? The shul we go to is boring. We're not going anymore. Yeah. But not only is it boring, they said. They said something much more important, because kids have said shul's been boring since, you know, Moses, right? You know? But what they said was, we're going to create our own. You taught us how to pray. You taught us how to use the prayer book. We're going to go down in the basement of the synagogue and start our own. And they did. And mushrooming all over this country are little minyanim, run by young folks, who said, I have an intuition that there is value, there is wisdom in this Jewish thing. I just don't like the way it's being done. I want to do it differently. All over the country, there is a rise of a new kind of creativity within Jewish life that tries to answer the fundamental question of Jewish discontinuity, which is, why be Jewish? Why live a Jewish life? Why give yourself to this thing, to this people? Why identify yourself with this people? And that is the place that we are in now. This moment of discontinuity, which has engendered this remarkable creativity. Now, I said to you last night that I learned a long time ago as a rabbi always to give the last line of the lecture first. Because it's Shabbos afternoon and all of you want to drift off and go to sleep. Right? So before you drift off and go to sleep, here's the last line of the lecture. You ready? Listen carefully. The last line of the lecture is, because of what I know about Jewish discontinuity over the course of Jewish history, I may be the last but the only one to still have faith in the resilience of the Jewish people. I don't think this is the end of the Jewish people in America. I actually think it's the beginning of something quite remarkable. Our end has been predicted too many times. In 1964, Look magazine did a cover article called The Vanishing American Jew. It was written by a very prominent Harvard sociologist who made the case that in American culture, ethnic groups last three generations. Italian Americans, Polish Americans, Irish Americans, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Mexican Americans, three generations. The first generation comes from the old country. They eat the old foods. They speak the old languages. They begin the process of assimilating into America. They tell their children, you need to assimilate into America. The second generation moves out of the Lower East Side, out to Brooklyn, right? Or moves out of, where is it in Chicago? South Side of Chicago?
West Side of Chicago?
Yes. You moved out to Skokie, right. That generation goes back to Bubby and Zeta's for the Seder,
still speaks a little Yiddish or Cambodian, right, or Spanish or Polish, still goes to the San Onofre Festival, the San Vittorio Festival, or High Holidays, but lives an American life. By the third generation, you have grandparents who still speak Yiddish, or Cambodian, or Vietnamese, or Chinese, or Japanese. But you know what? You only can filter fish out of a jar. No one has a carp in the bathtub anymore. By the fourth generation, this God is calling. By the fourth generation, there's nobody left who really likes the old foods. By the fourth generation, there's nobody who speaks the language fluently. By the fourth generation, there's nobody who remembers the stories and lullabies of the old country. That's when ethnic groups disappear. And by the fifth generation, they're gone. That's why we have Polish Americans, and they have Polish American restaurants and societies, but they have no real cultural guts. We have Italian Americans, and it's an affectation. Besides, we intermarry with each other, so everybody's half Italian, half Irish, half Moldavian, half Jewish, half Vietnamese, at least in my neighborhood, when they come to convert, right? The guy at Look Magazine said, American Jews, this was in 1964, are entering the third generation. This will be the last generation. By the fourth and fifth generation, he said by 1980, there'll be substantially fewer Jews in the United States, and by 2000, there'll be none. There'll be none. Here's what's interesting. Look Magazine is gone. Don't underestimate the creative resilience of this people. Don't underestimate the life force, the Elan in this people that gives it a posture, gives it a way of finding a way to continue to reinvent itself under moments of discontinuity. Don't underestimate that, and don't be afraid of that. The reason I keep coming back to this minyan, because I still have a pretty busy life in LA, the reason I keep coming back to this minyan is because I think this minyan, in many ways, this community of Eitz Chaim, is exactly that. It is a living ace. It is a living creature. It is a living organism that has shown a way to continue to reinvent Judaism for a new level. This and 100 other minyanim just like it across the country show me that the spirit of experimental creativity hasn't died within the Jewish people yet. Now, how do you make common cause between experimental communities like Eitz Chaim and more established communities, you know, like North Shore? How do you put this spirit in that building? That's part of the question. How do minyanim and communities develop from experimental circles of young people into more aging and mature and wise and established communities? This is what we're seeing around the country right now. But don't underestimate the creative capacity of the Jewish people to reinvent itself. That's the last line of the lecture. Now let's take a look. What we have in front of us is a remarkable tradition left by those who came before us to show us how do you do the process of experimentation. What are the rules of Jewish reinvention? Because we're not the first to step into this position, because we're not the first to step into this the creative tension and uncertainty, we have the stuff that they left behind. And what I want to do this afternoon, last night we talked about the destruction and what we learned from the destruction. Today I want to learn what our ancestors learned from the recreation of the Judaism in the wake of that destruction. I'm going to take a look at three texts briefly today and let you go home and meditate them on during the rest of the NCAA tournament, okay? What's going on right now. Everybody take a breath. Anyone have a question, a comment, a concern, a counter sermon? An endorsement of a Democrat running for Congress. Yes, who would you like to endorse?
My nephew, actually. But he's 10, so. You know, I think a lot of kids ask that question that you're saying that they don't know what they don't ask. And I think that they've been asking them for a long, long time. And the reason that fewer of them come back the next go around with their own children and their own families is because they never got an answer.
Right.
They had no, there was silence, and that of the ones who do come back, they have, you know, they honor some of the commandments. Oh, well, I'm honoring my father, or I'm honoring my mother. I'm honoring my past, and that's why I'm bringing my children here. There's nothing here for me, right? So I don't participate in the community because I don't need to, but my children need to go learn this stuff.
Right.
Right? And maybe they'll learn it better than me.
Right.
You know? And maybe they'll get something, you know, yeah. Who knows?
I want to tell you this story. When I was a rabbinical school teacher, I was a Hebrew school teacher. I made my living as a Hebrew school teacher when I was going to Rev school. One Sunday morning, I finished teaching, and I'm cleaning up my classroom, and I overhear the following conversation. It's a kid walking out of the school, not in my class, kid walking out of school for this dad. Dad says, "How is Hebrew school today?" Kid says, "Honestly, Dad, I hate it here. I don't want to ever come back. Teacher's mean, the kids aren't nice, it's so boring, it makes no difference, it's just no fun, I don't want to ever come back." Father stops, shoves the kid up against the wall, and says, "Listen, kid, I went to Hebrew school here, I hated it, it was boring, the teachers were mean, the same teachers, the kids were mean, it was all irrelevant, I had to go, you have to go." Thought number one, the hero of Jewish education is this father. Thought number two, what a catastrophe. I mean, what a catastrophe. So what happens? Let's take your comment, which is so interesting. At the Seder table, you're going to recite a midrash. The rabbis of the Talmud noticed that we are told many times during the course of the Torah to recite the story of the Exodus. So they wanted to know, why do you have to be told more than once? Whenever there's something given you more than once, it must mean there's a purpose for it. So the famous midrash is of the four sons, or the four children, who ask questions at the Seder. Ostensibly, that's a midrash to explain why it tells you four times in the Torah, tell the story of the Passover, right? So the first of the four sons is called the Chacham. And he asks what? Ma chukim ha-mishpatim asher tziva Adonai etchem, right? What are the laws and the customs that God has commanded you? And it says, because he asks about the laws and the customs, he's Chacham. Because the kid asks the question, how? You privilege him with being the honored one at the table. The second question, he's called the... Again, he's called the Rasha, the evil child, the wicked child. What does he say? Ma zeh lachem. What does all this mean to you? What does all this mean? And it says lachem below lo, because he says lachem to you and not to himself. He's excluded himself. But if you go back and read the Chacham's question, he says, what are all the laws and traditions that God commanded you? So it isn't you that the tradition is really objecting to. It's not the you and not him that it's objecting to. The difference is, the first kid asked how, the second kid asked why. The second kid said, what is the meaning of this story? How does this narrative affect your personal narrative? How have you made this narrative your narrative? He asks the most interesting of questions. But in a moment of Jewish continuity, we don't want that question. We just want people to keep doing it. We don't want them to stop and ask why. The how question belongs to continuity. The why question is the serious question of moments of discontinuity. The why question belongs to those moments when we need to reinvent our meanings. So the tradition castigates him as the Rasha. And then you get the most interesting one of all. She'eino yodea lishol. He doesn't know how to ask. Tell me, what kind of Jewish kid can't ask a question? At least you say, when do we eat? It's my brother-in-law's question, right? At least you say, when do we eat? But this is a kid who sits quietly at the table. Now, what's wrong? It's not that he's a baby. It's not that he's dumb or inarticulate. The problem is, he was yesterday's Rasha. Yesterday, last year, he came to the Seder and he says, Mazel Lachem, tell me what this narrative means to us. What is it? How does it work? How does it have meaning for us? How does it structure our own personal meaning in the world? Tell me what it means. And we said to him, shut up. Shut up. That's not the question. You're the Rasha. And so what did he decide to do? He shut up. So he comes to the Seder, but he sits there passively, not participating in the rite of the Seder, because he took us seriously when we told him to shut up. He is yesterday's Rasha. In 1990 and in 2000, the combined Jewish philanthropies of North America, the federations, did a major, major statistical study called the National Jewish Population Survey. In 1990, they found there were 5.5 million Jews in North America. In 2000, they found there were 5.2 million Jews in North America. They asked these people, what is your current religion? 20% checked the box labeled none. Non-Jews. Not Orthodox, not Conservative, not Reform, not Reconstructionist, not Renewal, not Zionist, not Anti-Zionist, not Left-Wing, not Right-Wing, not Progressive, not Conservative, none. Who are they? That's She'eno Yodei Elisho. It's the ones who said, what is the meaning of all of this? And we said, shh. Pasnish, don't ask. Yeah. See? You're exactly right. So now the question is, in a moment of discontinuity, can we find the capacity to both address those questions? Can we find the capacity within our circles of community to be courageous enough to address that question? Look at the second, my third page, and where it says Mishnah Avot chapter 1. Everybody see this? I swear we didn't rehearse this, although it really sounds good. It's page 3, Mishnah Avot. Now what's the scene? The Temple of Jerusalem was built by King Solomon in the year 970 BCE. It started out as a small wooden house. It was expanded many times during the course of Jewish history. For 75 years it was destroyed and then recreated after the Babylonians were taken down by the Persians. And it had stood on that site since 440 BCE. Beginning in the first century, Herod, who was a half-Jewish king who was trying to make his name in the Roman Empire, decided to remodel it. He needed more land. So what he did was build a retaining wall, put some fill dirt behind the retaining wall, and expand the platform for the Beit HaMikdash. And then on that platform built the world's most beautiful temple. The world's most beautiful temple. We know this because Roman authors talk about it as the world's most beautiful temple. Oh, incidentally, the Kotel, the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, was not a wall of the temple, was not a wall of any building associated with the temple. It was the retaining wall for the hillside. Only Jews would pray at a retaining wall, right? It's an interesting image when you think about it, right? Now, the temple was a cube of marble, the temple that Herod built. A cube of beautiful white shining marble with a golden parapet across the top, surrounded by three layers of columns. It was said to be the most beautiful building in antiquity. And on Pesach, it would fill with hundreds of thousands of pilgrims who would come there and fill the city of Jerusalem. Pilgrims from all over the world, Jews and non-Jews, came to offer homage at that particular temple. In the year 67, CE, after zero, the Jews who lived in Yerushalayim began a revolt against the Romans. The Romans needed to make an example of Jerusalem. They needed to make an example of the Jews, because if they allowed that revolt to succeed in any way or fashion, they would lose control of the empire. And so they land their most powerful legion, the 10th Legion, at Phoenicia. They march down the coast and then up the hillside. They besiege the city. On Shvasar B'Tammuz, on the 17th day of Tammuz, they breach the walls of Jerusalem. There's 3 weeks of brutal hand-to-hand combat through the streets of Jerusalem. And on Tisha B'Av, on the 9th day of Av, in the year 70, they destroy the temple. You can go to Jerusalem and get a sense of how angry they were. Because what the Israelis have done since then is excavate all of the walls, the areas around the temple. You go to the Davidson Archaeological Park. Go down to the street level. You can literally walk on Roman street level. At the end of the street, you see where the shops are? At the end of the street, there is the most amazing thing to look at. It is a cube of limestone. It is about 3 meters cubed. It's about 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet. This is what you say in French, a gazunda piece of rock, right? And it's sitting point down about a foot and a half into the stone. You can look up and see where it came from. They literally tossed this 100-ton piece of rock off the top. They were so angry at the Jews. Now imagine what that looked like in the eyes of the Jewish community that was there. Here's the temple, the center of religious life, of academic life, of judicial life. This is where the markets met. This is where the government sat. This was our symbol. This building had been there for more than 1,000 years. This temple was everything that connected Jews with their Judaism. And one afternoon in 70, it's gone. It's destroyed. Imagine what that looked like. Plus the horrible bloodshed of the revolt, of the massacre. Imagine what that looked like. And not just the temple, not just the courts and the academies and the marketplaces. The temple was the place where we met God. Remember that in the middle of the temple was a room called Kodesh HaKodeshim, Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum. In the first temple, the one built by Solomon, that's where the Ark of the Covenant sat. Right? The ark that Harrison Ford found in a movie, right? In the second temple, Harrison had been lost already. He was in that place where Harrison with the snakes, right? In the second temple, it was empty room, but it was believed with all of the hearts of the people of Israel that God lived in that room. So nobody went into that room ever except one guy once a year. The high priest would spend a whole month in meditation and study and preparation, so that he could fully concentrate on the welfare of the people Israel. And then wearing a white garment with tremendous trepidation and fear, he would go into that room on Yom Kippur to pray for the community. Because they believed that God lived in that room and God was dangerous, just before he went in, they tied a rope around his leg. If the poor son of Agan should drop dead in the middle of the ritual, nobody would have to risk his life getting him. They just slip him out with the rope. God lived in there. And one afternoon in 70, the whole thing is destroyed. So if you're a Palestinian Jew, a Judean, of that moment, what do you think? What are you thinking? What are you thinking? You're thinking that everything in your world is destroyed. Everything that's sacred to you is destroyed. Everything that connects you with your past is destroyed. Everything that establishes your identity is destroyed. Everything that connects you with God is destroyed. Look, we face what direction when we pray?
East.
Why? Because that's where Jerusalem is. And if you're in Jerusalem, which direction do you pray? Toward the Holy Temple. In other words, the Holy Temple orients us. Orient east. Get it? Orients us. Take away the temple, we are disoriented. Oh. I thought that was pretty cool. One more thing. Wait, it's better than that. Why did they build the temple on that spot? There was a rock there. A piece of rock. It was a piece of limestone. It was holy even before there were Jews. That's the place Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. That rock was called in Hebrew Evan Hashtia, the foundation stone of the universe, the navel of the world. This is the place where heaven and earth touched. By the way, that same rock today is under that very attractive golden dome, which is called the Dome of the... And that's the rock, right? But if you're a Jew of the first century, and you saw the temple destroyed, and you saw the thing exploded because it was made out of limestone, and when limestone heats up, it explodes. When you saw the temple explode, and you saw the Roman soldiers scurrying about, you had every right to believe that the world was knocked off its axis. Not just disoriented, it literally knocked off its axis, that the one thing in the world which kept the world stable was destroyed. So what happens? Well, there were some answers to this. There was what do the Romans say? If a Jew came to a Roman and said, what do I do now? What would the Romans say? Your God is no God. Or your God is weak. Our gods are powerful. Come and become a Roman. And I'm sure there were Jews who said, good, make me a Roman.
And there was another, there was a small sect that was teaching an idea that the Messiah had come 30 years earlier, and you killed him. And so they said, come and join us, because this is the punishment for having killed God's Messiah. They call themselves Christians. Anyone ever heard of them? They actually did pretty well, actually. I don't know. But a small group of Jews wanted to go on being Jews. The question is, what do you do? Turns out there was one rabbi who survived, the last Jedi. The last Jedi was Yochanan ben Zakkai, right? He cut a peace. He cut a separate deal with the Romans. That was last night's lecture. And he got himself a place called Yavne, a small town near the coast. And he set up shop with his students. Now I want you to imagine the refugees coming to Rabbi Yochanan, broken, despairing, out of their minds with rage, with pain, with loss. These were literally survivors. They come to Rabbi Yochanan and they say to him, what do we do now? Where do we go now? In what way do we do Jewish now? Everything that's Jewish was destroyed on that hillside. What did Rabbi Yochanan say to them? Because what he said next is going to either make or break Jewish history. This much I can tell you. If he would have said to them, don't worry, we'll get the temple back, we'll always have a temple, we'll wait, the temple will be rebuilt, we'll have sacrifices again. If he would have said that, we would have died as a people on that spot. So he knew he couldn't do that. Great moment of discontinuity. What do you say?
Study.
Well, here's what's wonderful. Here's what's wonderful. They left us the notes. There is no record of the conversation. No official record. But there's an unofficial record. Okay, this is the sort of Drudge Report or Politico or, you know, Huffington Post version of what happened. There is a book in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the code of Jewish law that was created about 150 years later. The Mishnah is all law. Very, very dense, terse law. Here's what you do if. Here's what you do when. Here's how you do this. Here's how you do that. There's one book in the Mishnah which has no law whatsoever. It really shouldn't be there. So the question is, why is it there? It's called Avot, which means the old guys. Pirkei Avot, the words, the sages, the teachings of the old guys. I think this is the book that tells you what Rabbi Yochanan said to the community. I think this is the book that tells you the principles of reconstructing Jewish life after a moment of discontinuity. Take a look with me. The funny thing about this book, every chapter of the Mishnah, every tractate of the Mishnah is divided up into prakim, into chapters, and the chapters are divided up into Mishnayot, Mishnah 1, Mishnah 2, Mishnah 3, okay? For some reason, there's a prologue. Now, why is there a prologue? Why shouldn't that be Mishnah 1? There's a prologue. Now, what is a prologue? When an author puts a prologue on a book, what is he trying to tell you? There's an old joke in rabbi school. I taught this to Lizzie when she was my student. You know, rabbis like to get up and say, before I say what I've come to say, I have a few things I want to say. You hear a person say that? Right? Before I give my speech, I have a few things I want to say. I told you never to do that, right? They did it. Why do you suppose they did it? Well, let's see what it says, and then we can see if we can answer that question. Here's a prologue. Ready? Kol Yisrael, Yesh Lahem Chelek Leolam Haba. All Israel have a portion in the world to come. Period. What word in that sentence is revolutionary?
Kol Yisrael.
What word in the sentence is revolutionary? What word is revolutionary? What word would you not expect to hear? What word will you almost never hear in contemporary Jewish discourse? The word, no, Olam Haba is in the world all over. We hear that a lot. Portion, we know a lot about too. Well, today you hear Porsche, not portion. That's how I read it. I mean, all Jews get a Porsche in the world to come. You know? I'll take a Mercedes if you want instead. A Lexus if you're of that ilk. No, it doesn't say that. What word is the radical word? All. All.
all? No, you don't mean all. You mean all conservative Jews. You mean all Reformed Jews. You mean all Orthodox Jews, all Hasidic Jews, all Jews who vote for the Likud, all Jews who vote for the Democratic Party, all Jews who make contributions to the building fund, all Jews who... That's what you meant to say, right? That's what you meant to say? All Jews have salvation?
Yeah.
All Jews are rewarded by God? All Jews have cookies in the next life? All? When have you ever heard anybody say all Jews? When have you ever heard that? Right? Super Sunday. You ever have Super Sunday here? Right? The Federation calls you up and says, hi, guess what? You're a wonderful Jew. Whether you give to us or not. You say, who is this? It's anti-Semitic. What is this? The only people talk about all Jews are the people who hate us. Right? All Jews is something that people who hate us talk about, right? All Jews are here. When did we ever say all Jews are blessed, all Jews are accepted, all Jews have a place in God's presence? What are they trying to say, and why is this a prologue? Let me put it a different way. Principle number one for the reconstruction of Jewish life after the catastrophe is what?
Acceptance of all Jews.
Yeah. Back in the other world, before the destruction, we could afford to be broken into parties and sects and cults and competing factions. We could afford to be separated. But now that we've gone through the cataclysm, at this point in our history, at this point in our experience, it's irrelevant who you were before. Sadducee, Pharisee, conservative, Orthodox, Reform, it don't matter no more. Litvak, Litzianer, Romanische, Gewalt, right? Yeah, it don't matter no more. It don't matter no more. Let it go. The first principle of rebuilding a Jewish community is inclusiveness. We have to find a way to include everybody. That's why it's a prologue and not the first Mishnah. Because this is going to be one of the abiding principles. We're going to disagree. And we're going to have to figure out a way to live within disagreement. Because in this world, we can't afford the factionalization and internecine rivalries that we had before. Now, principle number one of rebuilding the Jewish life in a moment of discontinuity is you got to find a way to have everybody in the game.
And now, how long does that
last? Interesting question. And who doesn't it include? That's what you really want to know, right? Yeah, I know all Jews have a place to welcome, but you didn't mean by all Jews. You meant all Jews who are, you know, like us. That's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer. Let's keep going until we can figure it out, right? And he gives you a proof text for this, which is interesting too. Now let's look at Mishnah number one. So principle number one of rebuilding a Jewish community in a moment of discontinuity is inclusive. Mishnah number one, okay? Somebody want to read for us? Anybody here read English fairly well? Anyone go to college? Please, go ahead.
Moses received the Torah at Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets. And the prophets to the men of the great synagogue.
Yeah. This is a very sexist. Yeah, the way it's going to get worse in a minute.
Wait,
stop there.
Their answer.
They've already excluded the women. Right. So Moses got the Torah. So what's the subject of this sentence? So the community comes to Yochanan ben Zakkai and they say, "What do we do now? Where do we worship now? How do we live now?" And his statement to them is, first of all of you are welcome. I don't care who you were in the old world. That's irrelevant now. You're welcome here. Let me tell you the first fact of Jewish life. Moses got Torah at Sinai. From now on, Jewish life is going to be about what?
Torah.
It's going to be about Torah. Moses got Torah, and he gave it to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets gave it to us. Who's missing from that list?
Judges.
Priests. No priests. Why are there no priests in that list? First of all, you don't need priests anymore. You don't have a temple. Second of all, the priests were hereditary castes. You could only become a priest. Someone told me the joke in line about the guy that wanted to be a Kohen, right?
Yeah.
You know that joke? You know, for $500,000, Rabbi, make me a Kohen. You know that story?
Yeah.
Right? Never mind. How do you get to be a Kohen if your father's a Kohen? How do you get to be a rabbi?
You have to study.
You have to study. In other words, no more hereditary ascriptions. This is now open to anyone who wants to study. Anyone can study Torah. Anyone can come close to God through Torah. It is now open to everybody. Kol Yisrael, everybody. And if you look at the next line, the men of the Great Assembly, or the members of the Great Assembly, the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, used to have three sayings. They had three teachings. What were they? Go ahead.
Be patient in the administration of justice, rear many disciples, and make a fence round the Torah.
Okay. Be patient in the administration of justice. If you're doing that, what are you doing? It's like a game show, right? If you're being patient in the administration of justice, you are a... Close. You are a... Administration of justice sounds a lot like a judge. You're adjudicating cases. You're leading the community by adjudicating its conflicts using Torah law. Number one, that's the first role of a rabbi. Number two, rear many disciples. You are a
teacher.
Number two is teaching. That's the second role of a rabbi. Make a fence around the Torah. You're a construction worker. Right? What does that mean, make a fence around the Torah? Protect the Torah doing what? Legislating. Mark.
Expanding
and legislating.
Keep it protected.
All right, I'll give you a quick synopsis of the meaning of that. I learned this, I lived in New York City in the 1970s. In the 1970s in New York City, we got a lot of tourists from Japan. They kept falling into the subway tracks. They'd either get electrocuted or hit by a subway car. This was of some consequence to the city of New York City. Not because they loved people from Japan, but because they slowed down the subway system. You have to know New York to know why that's very funny and true. Okay? So what they did was, the Chachamim, the great wise men who ran the Metropolitan Transit Authority in New York, put a yellow line across the edge of the subway platform and a sign in English and Japanese that said, "For your own safety, do not cross Yarrow Ride." Guess what happened? Japanese tourists kept falling into the subway tracks because they would keep their feet behind the yellow line, but they'd lean over to see the train was coming, and whoosh, they'd get... It took 2 years of Metropolitan Transit Authority wisdom before someone came up with the solution to the problem. Can anybody guess what the solution was? Yes, you move the line back 3 feet from the edge of the platform and put up the sign even bigger saying, "Please don't cross Yarrow Ride," right? Then people, if you don't cross this line, you will not fall into the subway tracks. That's why chicken is placious. Why is chicken placious? The Torah says, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. So we do not cook kids in their mother's milk. In fact, we don't cook any meat in any milk whatsoever. In fact, we have two sets of dishes for meat and for milk. We don't serve them on the same plate, on the same table. In fact, we don't have any meat in any milk whatsoever. How about chickens? You couldn't cook a chicken in its mother's milk. Chickens don't give milk. Duh. So chicken should be parred.
Yay.
Why is chicken fleshic? Because it looks a little bit like veal. And if you make a mistake and mixed up the chicken with it...
No, it doesn't.
She said, right? It looks a little bit look like meat. And therefore, if you mixed it up, you might end up eating the wrong thing and cooking it in its mother's milk. So chicken, because it's an extension of the law of kashrus, becomes fleshic. Okay? Tuna fish.
Yes.
Tuna fish looks a little, you have a tuna steak.
looks a little bit like chicken. They even call it chicken of the sea.
Why don't they make tuna fish flesh it?
Answer, what are you, crazy? It was nothing to eat. But at least they say cook each fish on a separate plate. You're not allowed to eat fish on the same plate that you eat meat, even though it's part. Get it? Can make any sense to you whatsoever?
No.
Make a fence around the Torah means extend the prohibitions of the traditions so that they do not, so that you don't get close to the point of prohibition. You're legislating Torah. You're legislating Torah. These are now the roles of a rabbi. Let's take a look at the second one. Ready? This one's the most important. Yeah.
But that's not what you can do.
Yeah.
So it's not telling you what you can do. I think it's a negative.
All right, read the next one for me. The next one will satisfy you.
Oh,
wow. I promise.
Shimon the Righteous was one of the last men of the great synagogue. He taught on three things the world suggests: on Torah, on worship, and on the practice of kindness.
If I had to bet, this is what I think Yochanan ben Zakkai said to the refugee. The refugees came to him and they asked him, what do we do now to be Jewish? And what connects us to our identity? What is the meaning of Jewish life? And they came to him, I think, with an even more bitter question. The question they wanted to know was, does God hate us? What kind of God allows his house to be destroyed, his city to be destroyed, and his people to be destroyed? Does God hate us? Is there anything left of our world? And inasmuch as they saw the temple explode, and they really thought that the Eben Hashtiyah, the foundation stone of the universe, had exploded with it, they really had a sense that their world, both psychologically and geologically, was off its axis. They come to Yochanan and they say, what do we do now? And Yochanan answers them with this teaching. Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omeg. Now there's two statements there. Statement one. Ha'olam omeg, the world still stands. That's amazing. Yes, you saw the temple destroyed. Yes, the priests and sacrifices are gone. Yes, so much of what we deem sacred is gone. But that doesn't mean that the world is finished. Ha'olam omeg, the world continues to persist. The world exists. Your world exists. But it can't exist on the foundations it had before. Those foundations were vulnerable. We have to find new foundations on which to rebuild this world. Ha'olam omeg, you did not lose your world. You lost a building in the middle of Jerusalem. Ha'olam omeg, you did not lose your God. You lost a building in the middle of Jerusalem. But you know something? We're a people, we've spent more of our history without the building in Jerusalem than with it, even then. What are going to be the new foundations of Jewish existence? In what way are we going to access God? Torah, avodah, gemilut chasadim. Torah. From now on, when you want to access God, you don't go to the building in Jerusalem. You open the book. And the book is available to everybody. Anyone who can read the book can become an authority in the book. Anyone who can be an authority in the book can teach the book. Anyone can find the book. The book is full of wisdom. Come to the book. And what is the institution that's going to teach the book? The school. Beit Midrash. Every Jewish community had a Beit Midrash. There is no word in Hebrew for what Americans call school. There is no word where you drop children off in the morning, they're educated during the day, and then you pick them up in the afternoon, all clean and sanitized and wrapped in plastic. There's no such word in Judaism. Because there never was an institution for only children, because learning never belonged only to children. That's an American invention, not a Jewish invention. In Judaism, it's the exact opposite. In America, you go to school to make a living. In Judaism, you make a living so you have time to go to school. In America, you go to school so you can have material things. In Judaism, you have material things so you'll have the leisure to sit and study. When Tevye was dreaming of being a rich man, what did he want? To sit and study the Holy Book 7 hours every day? That would be the sweetest thing of all. And every Jewish community had a Beit Midrash, and it was filled with grown-ups. Early in the morning before they went to work, late at night after they came home from work. I have in my library a wonderful book. It's a book of Mishnayot.
was a book of Mishnayot from the forestry service, the wood carriers of Bialystok. Every group of workers, every trade group, every guild had a study circle. They learned after work. They'd come back to the basement and learn for half an hour before they went home. So that children always witness grown-ups learning. So children aspire to be old enough to be able to attend the shiurim, the learning sessions of the grown-ups. The Beit Midrash, a place where all of us come to learn, is the center of the community. That, by the way, and not that, was the central institution of the Jewish community. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, except for one thing. It's built in the wrong direction. The Beit Midrash is in a circle where we can all learn from each other and see each other and gain each other's wisdom. Not sit theater style pointing to a beam. And the rabbi's job was just to teach one of the shiurim. Everybody taught everybody else. Now, there was a small room off to the side where little kids were learning in order to have access to the Beit Midrash, and that little room was called cheder. The word cheder, a cheder, means a room. It's the room off to the side of the Beit Midrash where the little kids would learn the alphabet so they could then take a seat in the Beit Midrash. Get it? Torah. Second word, avodah. We no longer have sacrifices. You knew that, right? Mark wants to bring him back. Well, this thing about dead animals. So, what do we have instead? Verbal prayer. And where do you do verbal prayer? In the Beit Knesset, in the synagogue. That's where you celebrate life. That's where you mourn together. That's where you pray for the ones who are sick. That's where you welcome new children to the community. Third institution, Gimilut Chasadim, acts of kindness. Where do you learn that?
From your parents.
Home. If you look at the Bible, you will not find in the Bible a philosophy of the Jewish home. Home is not an important category in Bible. It was the rabbis of the Talmud who created the ideology of a Jewish home, as a home of a place where you learn one of the ways to access God. It's the rabbis, and what the rabbis did so very cleverly is they took from the Beit HaMikdash, the rites of the Holy Temple, and they preserved many of those rites, but they translated them into the rites of home. I'll prove it to you. The egg bread, the twisted egg bread that you eat on Friday night, I used to live in Texas, so they used to call it their egg bread. What do you call that egg bread that you eat on Friday night?
Challah.
What does the word challah literally mean? It's the name of a sacrifice that was offered. It's a bread sacrifice. Now, you're going to put it on your table, right? You're going to make kiddush, you're going to bless your children, you're going to bless your spouse, and then before you're going to eat that beautiful chocolate chip cinnamon challah that you spent $7.99 for, you're going to do one more thing. What are you going to do first? No, before you do that, you're going to wash your hands. You're going to wash your hands, and you're going to say the bracha, Asher kitshan mitzvotav v'tzimano al metilas yadayim. Where are you commanded to wash your hands in the Torah? You're not. Who is commanded to wash his hands in the Torah? The priest offering the sacrifice. Now, you come to the challah, and you take this $7.99 cinnamon chocolate chip challah, and you say Motzi Lechem in Haaretz, and before you tear into it, you do one more thing.
Salt.
Why would you put salt on a cinnamon? Because every sacrifice was offered with salt. The rabbis introduced all these gestures of sacrificial worship into the home ritual so that you become the priest. Your table becomes the mizbeach, your meal becomes the altar, and God comes and eats dinner with you.
And you can't talk either.
Only that one moment. Only that one moment. This is the funniest thing in the world, by the way. Faces. So you're introducing sacred symbols into the home. Now, here's what's interesting. Tell me what is ostensibly holy about this place next to Lake Michigan in Highland Park, Illinois. Was there ever a miracle right here?
No.
Who knows?
Was there ever, did a martyr ever die right here? Did God ever show up in somebody? In the Bible, wherever Jacob has a dream and God shows up, they make an altar out of it. Bethel becomes an altar. Gilgal becomes an altar. Right? In the New Testament, in the Christian tradition, you put up a church wherever a saint is buried. That's why you have Saint So-and-so's place, right? And if they couldn't get a whole saint, they took a piece of the saint, and they put it in a reliquary, and you get the finger of Saint Anne, you know?
I don't think they call it that, though.
You don't think so? Anyone ever been to Venice? Who is the patron saint of Venice? San Marco. Where was San Marco buried? Saint Mark. He was buried in Istanbul, Constantinople. What did the Venetians do? They invaded Constantinople, slaughtered all the people, stole Saint Mark, brought him back to Venice, buried him, and built the cathedral on top of him. Right? And everything else that they stole, too. Right, right. Anybody buried here?
I doubt.
Rabbi North Shore is buried here. Know why they named it that? Rabbi North, Rabbi Shore, Rabbi Shore. I don't know. No. Why is this a holy place? Because Jews gathered to study here. That's exactly right. From now on, what makes a place holy is that a circle of Jews gathered to study, to pray, and to do chesed. If we study, pray, and do chesed in a place, that place becomes holy. Any place becomes holy. You have now not only democratized the tradition by making it accessible to any Jew, you have also made portable the Jewish tradition. That means that you take your Jerusalem with you. Now that did something, by the way, to the real city of Jerusalem. At the end of every Seder, what do we say? At the end of Yom Kippur, what do we say? Next year in Jerusalem. How come we didn't go back? How come from the year 70 until the year 1896, we didn't, in large numbers, we never went back? Small groups went back. We went visiting. We visited. It's even funny. It's even crazy. We said the Shana Babi Yerushalayim, right? In a few minutes, we'll talk about mysticism. In the 16th century, Jews went from Spain to Tzfat. Why do they go to Jerusalem? How can they say Roshana and be in Tzfat and not go to Jerusalem? Now, I mean, you know, if you're in Warsaw, I understand why it's hard to get to Jerusalem. But you're in Tzfat; it's one bus ride. Well, you change the Haifa, but it's not that hard. I mean, it's one bus ride. Why didn't they go to Jerusalem? Very simple reason: because of this ideology that said God lives with us wherever we do Torah, Avodah, Gemilut, Chasadim. Jerusalem ceased to be a geographic place and became the name of a world redeemed. Jerusalem became the name of the messianic dream, not a real place. That's why, we did this a couple of years ago, so I won't repeat the whole lecture, but a couple of years ago we studied Zionism together. And I told you that one of the great ironies of Jewish history is, it took a Jew who didn't know a lot of Judaism, a man named Theodor Herzl, who didn't go to Hebrew school, and so he didn't know that Jerusalem was a dream. Schmuck. He thought it was a real place. He thought it was a real place. So he stood up and said, we're going to go back to Eretz Yisrael. People said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, it's a real place. They said, no, it's a dream. It's an ideology. It's a philosophy. And he said, no, it's a real place. It took a Jew who didn't know better to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. And it took a collection of Jewish rebels who rebelled against this theology to rebuild the state of Israel. To rebuild. In other words, the tradition of discontinuity that was the rabbinic tradition became the new orthodoxy. And it took a group of rebels who rebelled against that. Godless, God-rejecting, bareheaded, treif-eating, Shabbos-breaking, not praying, not paying dues to the synagogue, bar mitzvah boys and girls, like my parents, who went back to Eretz Yisrael and settled the land. And David Hartman, my teacher, has a beautiful thing. He says, it's like the kid who gets so mad at his parents and says, I hate you, I don't want to have anything to do with you, I can't stand you. He comes out the door, he slams the door, crosses the street, and moves in with grandma. Exactly what Zionism is. Right? He rejected Judaism in the name of Judaism, or in the name of the Jewish people, is really what they did. So this is the beginning of an ideology. that gives us the wherewithal to survive the Holocaust of the first century and opens up a door to an entirely new way of doing Judaism. While these elements of Torah Avodah Gemilut Chasadim, of Torah learning, of Torah observance, of verbal prayer, of acts of chesed, these existed within Judaism from the very beginning. It was the rabbis who organized them, who brought them from backstage to front stage, brought them to the fore, and wove out of them a way of Jewish living. And Pirkei Avot, this chapter especially of Pirkei Avot, is the guiding ideology of how do you rebuild a community after a Holocaust. This is the guiding ideology. This is how they did it. And you get from this two things. Number one, you get from this sort of the principles of how to do it. Because whatever Judaism we're going to create for the next generation has to have in it these elements of Torah, Avodah, Gemilut Chesed. More than that, what you get from this, what I think you get from this, is the courage to experiment. Because for just a moment, try to appreciate the chutzpah of this guy. What remarkable chutzpah. What did he say here? He said, ladies and gentlemen, we have lost the temple of Jerusalem, and the priests, and the sacrifice, and our physical place, geographic place in the world, but we have not lost God. In fact, the reason we lost that temple was because that temple ceased to be a gateway to God and became an obstacle. Now we can be closer to God than before. He turned the catastrophe into an opportunity for deeper spiritual growth. He turned the catastrophe into a moment of birth. A moment of death became a moment of birth, of a new Jewish life. And the Talmudic tradition is what spells all of this out in greater detail. Take a breath. Everybody take a breath. We'll do one more. We're going to do one more Jewish revolution that we're going to call it today. Any questions so far? Comments, concerns, counter-sermons? Please.
Yes, the token member of North Shore Congregation.
I'm very respectful. This is a beautiful place. You're very lucky to have us.
I agree, and there's been a lot of stuff.
No, I'm not.
Sanctuary, but I want to say something.
I'm not making fun of you.
I want to say something.
Okay, please.
In all due respect, there's been a lot of discussion about the main sanctuary.
Yeah.
However, several years ago, they built a smaller sanctuary.
It's beautiful.
And when we pray there, we pray in the round.
Yeah.
And we have many classes there, and they're in the round.
Yeah.
So I agree with you on one hand, and on the other hand, I just wanted you to...
What's your name?
Enid Brick.
Oh, I'm Mrs. Brick. I'm Ed Feinstein. How are you?
It's about you.
Now you're going to go say all bad things.
No, you know why? That's us.
My teacher, one of my great teachers is Yitz Greenberg. And Yitz Greenberg was once asked the question, are you Orthodox, conservative, or Reform, and what difference does it make?
Right.
And Yitz's answer was, it doesn't matter whether you're Orthodox, conservative, or Reform, as long as you're ashamed of it. Right? I want to say to you, some of you don't know me, I have said much more brutal things about my own synagogue than I would ever say about yours. I apologize if I've said anything.
The reason I'm here is because I've heard very good things.
You're very
about you.
But I really am not trying to make fun of the shul. It's a really beautiful place. And
no, the
history,
point I was really trying to make was that I agree with you about the front-to-back business.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, 20 years ago or so, they built a different type of situation.
Right.
That lends itself more to what you're talking about, so that there has been an evolution.
Absolutely,
also.
And the principle in synagogue architecture and in synagogue organizational structure, because I study this stuff, is that every generation gets the synagogue its parents dreamed about. This was built by people, I guess, when was this built? In the 70s?
60s.
In the 60s and 70s? Right. So this was built by people who had been raised among, you know, people of meager means who had come to Chicago to make a life, and they built this magnificent synagogue to say, isn't Jewish life magnificent? And the problem is that the day they opened it, it was obsolete, because on that day their kids said, no, let's sit in circles and talk to each other. So, and the new synagogue that you built, the beautiful little chapel, is exactly the right synagogue for this moment, but the next group of kids is going to do, they're going to want to meet down here in the basement. So that's the problem with synagogue architecture. So.
This was Rabbi Siskind's dream, and he was of a whole different...
I don't. I'm not making fun of that. If you get thrown out of the school, I apologize. I'm really sorry. I wasn't making fun of you. I'll call. What's his name? Mason? I'll call
On the Quran Avodah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't say that it has to be either site-specific or building-specific.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's counter to that.
Yeah, exactly right.
Right? Because the notion of God living in the holy is
right,
as opposed to being imminent.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, it doesn't say you need a congregation
right
to do this.
Yes.
Or a basement.
Right.
It could be in your house.
It does. Exactly right. But what I'm indicating is that out of this grew mm-hmm. a whole new set of institutions. That this ideology...
Which made the same mistake.
Which did. Exactly. So there were... And you'll see that in a moment if you open the Rambam and then the Hasidic text, in which there were later moments of discontinuity mm-hmm. that overturned the orthodoxies of those. One generation's revolution
right.
becomes the next generation's orthodoxy. As my father would say, you know, conservatives are worshippers of dead radicals. You know? Seriously, when you hear a guy talking about, we want to restore America to the principles of our founding fathers. Your founding father was a lawless, crazy man who you broke away from the King of England. I mean, the same thing here. This became unorthodox. But what I think is really interesting is what you said a moment ago. It's very important. The question they wanted to know was, okay, so if God doesn't live in a building in Jerusalem, where does God live? Where does God live? How do you get to God? This brings us actually to the Hasidic text in a minute. So what they did was, you know, unfortunately, in this shul, you guys don't do Musaf, because there's something in the Musaf Amidah. In the Musaf Amidah, there is, in the Kedusha, there's a remarkable couplet. There's a line from the book of Ezekiel. Prophet Ezekiel was a prophet of the first Babylonian exile. And you can imagine those people asked similar questions. Where is God if the temple got destroyed, the first temple? And they asked God, Ayeh Mekom Kvodo. If the temple is destroyed and we're stuck here by the waters of Babylon, where is the place of God's glory? And Ezekiel answers the popular question by saying, Kvodo Malei Olam. God's glory fills the world. Well, if God's glory fills the world, you don't need to go to Jerusalem to worship God. If God's glory fills the world, then God is around you all the time. And if God's glory fills the world, then the loss of the temple is only a loss of a place to worship. Any place can be a place to worship. If God's glory fills the world, if Kvodo Malei Olam is true, then the problem of feeling that God is far away is not a problem of metaphysics. It's not that God really is far away. It's a problem of perception. Is that you can't know, you don't know it. You don't feel God's presence being so close. Kids in my school always want to ask me the question, if God spoke to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Rebecca and God spoke to Moses and Aaron, how come God don't speak to us anymore? And the simplest answer to that question is, God does. We don't listen. What Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were good at wasn't that God spoke to them. God speaks to all of it. They know how to listen. We don't. It's the perceptual problem. So what did the rabbis do? The rabbis tried to create a mechanism, a curriculum, for teaching us to perceive the presence of God in all moments. You all know it. You know it by heart. You've known it since you were three. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam dorom tidom. A blessing is a statement that says that in a given experience of a piece of challah or an apple, the given experience of a thunderstorm or a morning waking up, I perceive the presence of God. Or if I work hard enough, I can perceive the presence of God. The word baruch, we translate it as praise. It's better translated as from the word berach, meaning knee. I kneel. When do I kneel in front of somebody? We don't do that very often. In the old days, to kneel in front of a king, to kneel in front of an officer. The only time I can think of when we kneel now, anyone know, when do we kneel now? When you want to propose marriage to somebody, you kneel in front of them, right? Oh, you're taken, I'm sorry. Why do I kneel in front of this girl when I want to marry her? Because I wanted to tell her that she was the center of my universe. I kneel before you, Adonai. I kneel before you, God. Eloheinu melech haolam, who is present in all of phenomena, all reality, but who has revealed to me in this tuna fish sandwich umami. That's what you're saying in the bracha. In this particular moment, I perceive the presence of the reality of all realities. I'm trying to erase the perceptual problem of my sense of distance from God. That's what the bracha meant to say. So out of this flows this whole theology that you're all familiar with, this rabbinic Judaism. That's what rabbinic Judaism tried to do. But you're right. It became a set of institutions that then needed to be overthrown. If you want to see how Maimonides overthrows it, take a look at page 4. Can I ask questions for you?
When you keep talking about the temple and being destroyed, the visual to me is 9/11,
right.
The towers, and I understand it. And you can maybe just go off on a whole tangent about the temple and 9/11 or whatever.
No, exactly right.
You can go off on a tangent. But I just imagine that the terror in the people's faces, how it looked on 9/11. And then for a while, that's something I asked, how long did that last when everyone came together? The same thing, 9/11, the United States came together, the world sent us letters and said, we love you, and we're here to protect you, and we're going to make it okay, and then people can say it's okay that the dad didn't come home, and mom didn't come home, and they did all those different things, and now it's 10 years later, and we don't like those people anymore, and then those parts of organizations, is what Monty said, that in that part, then they very quickly forget how much, and then I also, my other thought at the same time is, this piece of where we are in this continuity, does any of that have to do with what happened 10 years ago? Did that, and I know some of that reawakening, you said, was 1990, what happened there? Did any of this also make that shift? Which I see in you and I talk.
Yeah, I think that what you're saying is very important. Yeah. Let me just suggest an analogy that might, I want to pursue what you said, because it's very important. What did we learn from 9/11? How did we allow 9/11 to change us? What symbolic forms did we adopt in order to make sure that some of the best parts of that 9/11 experience would never leave us? In a certain way, and I'm going to be critical of America, because America's got enough sorrows, you know, We lost an opportunity. You know, we could have, if we had been more creative, more aware, more sensitive, we could have done something with 9/11 to turn it from a moment of utter horror and terror and destruction to a moment of rebirthing and reawakening of a new American spirit. And we didn't do that. And so life is pretty much the same now as it was just before. And what here you have a bunch of rabbis who were very sensitive to the power of that experience. That was a different circumstance, different kind of, granted, but here you have a bunch of guys who said, let's take this catastrophe and let's find a way to build on it and to create symbolic forms that enhance and enrich the quality of this community's life instead of letting the catastrophe pass and life slip back to normal. Now, I know there are reasons why.
And it will also be that part. I mean, Irwin came right after 9/11 because it was Yom Kippur, and so he came and he said, this is going to be our grandchildren who we don't even know yet. It's going to be their history to reinvent. It's going to, like, it will go into so many different generations we can't even touch yet. And so on some level, some of this
right, and in a certain way, again, if I was being critical of America, which I'm not going to be because I'm not that kind of person, you might want to say that what ended up staying with us from 9/11 was the TSA and a heightened sense of fear and a heightened sense of paranoia and a smaller sense of American possibilities instead of that wonderful, remarkable moment of community where you could strike up a conversation with the guy you were standing next to in the bank line and where people let each other go first and there was a sense of communal and collective generosity. Instead of that sense of American community, we let it slip into a different channel. You could have imagined that the destruction of the temple would have left us a bitter, angry people. The rabbis wouldn't allow that. Al-Shloshah Dvarim Ha'olam Omeid is a mighty and heroic effort to turn what was so difficult and so ugly into an opportunity to grow closer to each other and closer to God. I mean, in a certain way, it's a remarkable genius of community organizing. So it's a really interesting question. It's a very interesting question. And as we talked about last night after supper, it occurs to me that one of the principal questions of our generation that we really haven't really worked on enough yet is the following question. Among us live survivors of the Holocaust. God bless them with long years. But within the next 25 or so years, they'll all be gone. And at that moment, the Shoah will turn from memory to history. And we will be forced with the question, what should we remember? You know, just like the Seder table says, and that day your child will ask you, what is all this about? And what story will we tell our children about the Shoah? What story will we tell? And what lessons will we learn? And how will we commemorate Shoah? And will the commemoration of Shoah, of Holocaust, make us stronger, deeper, kinder, more gentler, more godly people? Or will it make us angry, vicious, aggressive, violent, chest-beating, saber-rattling,
resentful
people? Bitter. And that, to me, is a serious question. And right now, I don't know the answer to that question, because I see evidence. I see evidence of what I call the PTSD of the Holocaust, like seeping in to mainstream Jewish life. The rage. There's no rage here. You notice what it says? The first principle is Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelek Le'olam Haba. Every Jew is welcome here. It doesn't say screw the Romans. It doesn't say all the goyim are evil. It doesn't say anything like that. It's you're welcome. Come in. Come in. Yeah, there were fantasies. I mean, you know, you ever read the Seder? You ever have a traditional Haggadah? You know that section of traditional Haggadah? It says the 10 plagues, and then there's these three Midrashim. One guy says, it wasn't 10 plagues, it was 50 plages. And then Rabbi Yochanan says, it wasn't 50 plagues, it was 500 plagues. And Rabbi Akiva says, it was 5 million plagues. You know, all right. And then Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, you know, there's rage in Jewish life, but we've never let that rage define us. Isn't it interesting that they won't let the rage define them? And I worry about our community in that direction. That's a whole other sermon, but you get a sense of where we're going.
I'll come back to that.
There's another aspect, and I'm not sure what I'm going to say is true, but I have a suspicion it is. I'm very interested in names, proper names, and their origin. And so ask yourselves what is going on with these different Mishnahs and how it's being organized. The first mission of Moses, and passed on finally to Simeon the Righteous. Who is Simeon the Righteous? What do we know about him? I can tell you this. Antiochus of Socho, who was he? I didn't tell you who he was.
Yeah.
He was a Greek. Okay? He was a Greek Jew.
Yeah.
Go further down.
Yeah.
Yotzer of Zeradah. You know where Zeradah is? It's in the fourth Mishnah.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know anything about Zeradah? It's in Yehuchus. Yeah. It's in Persia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
These are Jews from all over the ancient world they're
right.
talking about.
Who came together.
Not just Jews of Israel.
Right.
The land of Israel.
No, right? Exactly right. Yeah.
So I think it's important to integrate the thought that these wisdoms are not coming just from a group of people who were priests or even rabbis.
No, it's exactly right. It's very true.
So.
Good. Yes.
See, again, you have to talk about time. When you talk about the time for recovery, because whenever it's such, like what you said originally, when you go from being oriented to being disoriented, or when you go from tragedy to recovery, so it's time. It doesn't matter. It's, we don't know the timeline from when the temple's destroyed and they're back together and you have to go. You have to come from hate and fear, and it's a process to go back to Hamlet, to Hasid, to kindness and love.
Right. Right.
And where we are in that process, you're right, in America,
right.
is very interesting, because clearly after 9/11 we have gone to a place of fear and isolation as a country. And then how do you get back to openness and love?
Yeah, please.
You have to have a certain amount of distancing, just like with the Holocaust or with 9/11. With the Holocaust, there were decades where it was wasn't talked about, it wasn't taught. I mean, it was just something that was there and was heavy in our hearts. I mean, and decades later, we were able to come together. Yom HaShoah wasn't even a holiday when I, for many years, until I was, you know, quite an adult.
Yeah.
Going to Jewish day school and being the child of a survivor, it was never discussed.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It was an uncovered. And I guess the same thing with 9/11. You have to have a certain amount of distancing before you can come and have a broader vision beyond just the...
Right. Good. Generation. All right, let's finish. I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
When we talk about Kol Yisrael,
yeah.
Are we including all of those who may be born Jews, but there is no affiliation, no identification, nothing? They're out there.
Yeah.
How are you bringing them into this world of creativity and continuity again from this
kind. Yeah, see, but I think that's what's wonderful about the statement. It's not what you expect it to say. If you know Jews and you know the Jewish community, you expect the word except in there. Right? Or only if, or may, you expect a qualification or a conditional.
No, I'm asking you
how. No, I think you're exactly that. That's exactly the point, though. So now you're going to say, the Jewish community, the Judaism that I'm going to find a way toward, is a Judaism that has to be accessible to everybody and welcoming to everybody, and to anyone who wants to come in, and anyone who wants to call himself Yisrael can come in. And if you look at the proof text is interesting. First of all, Mishnahs never have proof text, so why do they need a proof text altogether? And second of all, the proof text comes from late Isaiah. Your people shall all be righteous. They shall possess the land forever. They are a shoot of my planting, the work of my hands, in whom I shall be glorified. He's talking to people that have just lost their land. And Isaiah is saying, no, my people shall be attached to this land, shall be attached to each other forever. It's a remarkable statement. So leave it as the challenge that it is. Let's finish with one more text. Is that okay?
Yep.
You guys cool for one more?
Yeah.
The next round of the NCAA will start with.
We have to do Maimonides or the.
Which would you prefer? I was going to do the Hasidic text.
Yeah.
That's the Hasidic. All right, I'll give you a Pesach table game to play, okay? So, my thesis again is that in moments of Jewish discontinuity, this people has found the wherewithal, the inner strength, the courage to reinvent itself, to reimagine its mission, to reimagine its value, to reinterpret its values, and to reinvent its institutions. But that's exactly what we do. That's Judaism. And that we're living through one of those moments now. And that the courage to experiment, to invent, to reimagine, the courage to be open to people of different ways and different ideas is exactly what's called for. That's the healthy part. That holding on to what was, only because it's what was, is not healthy for a community in moments of discontinuity. I want to move you now from 70 to the year 1700. The 1600s, the 17th century, one of the worst centuries in all of Jewish history, probably the third worst, behind the 20th century and the first century.
The
1600s. You have the Chmielnicki massacres, you know, a rising up of the Polish peasantry against the Polish nobility, led by a Cossack national movement. And because the Jews were under the protection of the Polish nobility, the Cossack national movement and its Polish peasant affiliates went slaughtering Jewish communities all over Eastern Europe. 300,000 Jews or so were killed in the Chmielnicki massacres at the beginning of the 1600s. Then you have a rise of messianic fervor. Jews believe if times are so bad, this must be the birth pangs of Messiah. Shows up a crazy, charismatic, Spartic Jew by the name of Shabtai Tzvi, tours all of Eastern Europe. Thousands and thousands of Jews in Eastern Europe decide he's the Messiah. They sell their possessions and they follow him, including thousands of children. After all, if he's going to go to Eretz Yisrael and redeem Eretz Yisrael, I'll send my kids. What happens? Shabtai Tzvi leads this children's march, gets to the border of the Ottoman Empire. The Turks arrest him. They enslave all the children. They enslave all the women, they murder all the men, and they put Sabtayt's feet to the choice, convert to Islam or die. He converts to Islam. And there is a sense of utter dejection. The dream has died. Third, the rabbis who are part of the community, running the community, decide that the problem is the messianic fervor. And so they begin to teach a new philosophy to try to stamp down that fervor. And that philosophy becomes the core of what we like to call the yeshiva culture. They taught that only the wisest, only the most pious, only the most learned can approach God. And so we're going to build schools, yeshivot. And the wisest, most pious, most learned will attend those schools, and the rest of you will support them. You can't get close to God. You're not wise enough. You can't get close to God. You're not learned enough. You can't get close to God. You're not pious enough. But you can support a yeshiva boy who is. And they put God at the pinnacle of yeshiva life so that only the wisest, most pious, and most learned can come close to God. All the rest of the Jewish people are effectively disenfranchised. We're enfranchised only in an associative way. And there is, by the end of the 17th century, by the end of the 1600s, a palpable sense of collective depression. The sense that we are abandoned, God is far away, there is nothing to Jewish life, and Jewish life begins to deteriorate. Into this mix is born a new idea. It was born in the person of a man named Israel ben Eliezer, who was a teacher, he's a Hebrew school teacher, really. And he goes around, as he hits maturity, he starts going around giving lectures, giving little shiurim, and doing miracles. He would do little miracles. He would cure you from your arthritis. He would do little miracles, cure your toothache. He'd do little miracles, raise the dead, walk across the lake, this kind of stuff. And they said, because a person who did miracles did it because he had the magic of God's name, so they called him the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov, the teacher of the name, the owner of the name. The Baal Shem Tov, and sometimes you abbreviate Baal Shem Tov, call him the Besht, right? The Baal Shem Tov begins to gather a circle of disciples and he begins to teach an ideology. And the ideology is the opposite of the yeshiva culture ideology. The idea, if the yeshiva culture ideology is that only the best and the brightest, the most learned and pious can approach God, the ideology of the Baal Shem Tov sounds a lot more like Ezekiel. Ayei Mekom Kvodo, where is God's glory? Kvodo Malei Olam, God is in all places and all things. Well, let me tell you something. If God is in all places and all things, why are you inside of a synagogue on a beautiful sunny day? You should be out at the lake. Right? If God is in all things and all places, the rabbi has truth, it's truth. But so does the shoemaker. And so do the children. And so does the butcher. And so does the tailor. In fact, sometimes if you listen to the tailor and watch him do his tailoring, you can see that he's holier than the rabbi. Because he tailors with more heart than the rabbi teaches Torah. If God is available in all things and in all moments, what is it that keeps you from God? Your perception, misperception, that God is far away and available only to the righteous. And that perception is strengthened by your depression. Your very depression, your very sadness is what keeps you from knowing that God is close. It's almost like God is right here on your shoulder. And you're sitting here crying, "Bye, man, God is so far. God doesn't hear me. God isn't close to me." And God is like, "I'm right here. I'm right here. Hello." In fact, there's this beautiful image. There's a beautiful image in one of the Hasidic masters. Because you know it says in the Shema Yisrael, right? It says in the Shema Yisrael, "Ani Adonai Elohecha," right? At the end, "Adonai Elohecha Memet," right? "Ani Adonai." So it has an image of a Hasid, of a Jew davening, right? And he's trying to do kavana. And he's concentrating on his prayer. Shema Yisrael! And God is right next to him going, "I'm right here. You don't have to shout. I'm right here. It's like Ghost. You see the movie Ghost?
Yeah.
You know that scene in the movie Ghost that makes every woman in the world, the greatest chick flick ever made, the greatest date movie. Ghost, take a girl to see Ghost. You'll thank me later. Trust me. me on this one. You have to sit through it. It's a long minute, but there's one scene in it that has to do with a pot. And trust me.
Right?
You know what I'm talking about, right? So God is right. You know what I'm talking about? You know the movie Ghost? Well, wait till you're a little older and you have a girlfriend and you go see it and you'll thank you. Right? It's that, you know, God is right there. The Besh, the Baal Shem Tov taught, he quoted the mystical tradition, Leit Atar Panui Mimo. There is no place that's God-free. And therefore, every place and every moment has God, and all you have to do is shake off the depression and sing. Shake off the depression and dance. Shake off the depression and be joyful, and you will feel the presence of God. That's classic Hasidism. That's classic Hasidism. Hasidism was a revolt against Orthodoxy. Now, I know that sounds really ironic, knowing where it is today. But there's a classic story. I think I told this story to some years ago. The classic Hasidic story goes like this. Because Hasidism was a folk tradition, it was told not in discursive philosophies, but in stories. So the tradition goes, the story goes like this. A Hasid and a Litvak are talking to each other. Already this is a fantasy. Right? Litvak is a Lithuanian Jew of superior rationality and pedantic personality. And the Litvak says to the Hasid, "You Hasidim don't obey the law. You ignore the traditions. You don't obey the rules. There is a time to daven in the morning and there's a time to daven in the evening, and you Hasidim don't pay attention to the rules." Hasid responds, "You know something, my brother? You're absolutely right. I'll tell you what happens. I get up in the morning. I'm going to daven on time. I take my talis and my tefillin and my siddur, and I go to the window. And as I'm putting on my tefillin, I open the window. The morning flows in. I smell the air in the morning. I hear the birds singing. I see children on their way to school. I see grown-ups on their way to work. The energy of the morning, the music of the new day fills me. It fills me. It fills me so much, I forget to daven until it's too late. Nebuch. Comes evening time. I'm going to daven on time. Sitting. I go to the window. I open the window. The night is falling. Peace comes across the countryside. It's quiet, it's cool. I see families gathered around their hearths all over the town. I smell the smell of cooking. I hear the song, the quiet, peaceful song of the night. I'm so filled with that peace of the night. By the time I come back to myself, never. It's too late to daven. That's my problem. So tomorrow, he said, tomorrow I have a solution. Tomorrow, I'll close the window. And the Litvak says, "God forbid." That's how you know it's a Hasidic story. God forbid. Now, what is that story about? Listen to the story, right? And there's 100 stories like that one. There's 100 stories like that one. The Hasid does not obey the rules because he is so caught up in the religious moment, which is the exact moment that the ritual is supposed to get you to, that he doesn't observe the ritual. That is, he lives in a world in which God is so close to him, he doesn't need the tools of ritual in order to get close to God. That's Hasidism. That's the ideal of Hasidism. So one of the ironies, sort of tragedies of this, is that that revolt against Orthodoxy ended up being co-opted by Orthodoxy, but that's another night. That's another lecture. So this is Hasidism. It was a way at this moment of Jewish depression, of Jewish crisis, of Jewish, in the internal crisis of the Jewish soul, it was a way of reinventing Judaism so that we wouldn't lose touch with God. This was not a destruction wrought from the outside, like the Romans destroying the temple. This was an internal destruction. An internal destruction. And so the community reinvents itself around this Hasidic idea. I brought you one little shtickel Hasidism so you can enjoy this. It also has a good Pesach thing. So take a look on the very last page. One of the last of the great...
Before you take a drink.
Almost done. We'll be done in 5 minutes. We'll give you a great Pesach table game in a minute. Right?
Last page.
to the last page, last source, last few minutes. Ready? One of the last of the great old world Hasidic masters was Rev Aryeh Leib of Ger. He was born in 1876. He died in 1907, 1908, something like that, right before the First World War. He was the rabbi in a community called Ger, G-E-R, which was a suburb of Warsaw. And he moved the community from the suburb into Warsaw proper. Now, Warsaw, at the turn of the century, was a booming community of Jewish revolutionaries. There were Bolsheviks, and communists, and socialists, and Zionists, and nationalists, and Yiddishists, all kinds of different revolutionary movements trying to reinterpret Judaism. And the Rebbe, the Gera Rebbe, knew this, and he was aware of this, and he understood that his role wasn't just to preach to his Hasidim, he understood that his role was to preach to that larger Jewish world. So every Shabbos afternoon, right about now, Shabbos afternoon, after shul, people would go home and take a nap, they'd come back to the shul 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, and there'd be a table set up, right? And they would sing a nigun, right? And then they would have a little schnapps, and a piece of kugel, and the Rebbe would teach a little bit. And they would sing a nigun, have a little schnapps, a little kugel, and the Rebbe would teach a little bit. And this would go on until midnight. Now there was one chassid who never drank. He was the designated chassid, right? And his job was to remember by heart everything the Rebbe said. And as soon as Shabbos was over, and as soon as the shir was over, he'd run home and he'd write it down. So he was writing down basically lecture notes from memory. And then he would bring them to the Rebbe in the morning, the Rebbe would correct them, and they were published in the Yiddish newspapers all over Warsaw the next day, because they were published for a much wider audience than just the Hasidim. These have been collected in a wonderful collection called Svat Emet. Svat Emet literally means plain truth, language of truth, or plain truth, plain speaking. And Svat Emet is one of the last of the great pre-war Hasidic texts. It has been translated now, a selection of it's been translated by Arthur Green. And you can get it, I think it's called Language of Truth. It's a very nice little book. So this is a little piece of Svat Emet, okay? Now you've got to remember, this is not the lecture. These are notes from the lecture. You have to fill in all of the gaps and things that he forgot to write down. Sometimes, by the way, in the original, there's a bracket where he'll say, in any zocher, right? Or I don't remember what he said here. Or I lost my place. Or I spilled the schnapps on the notes. You know, because he writes this. It's very funny where he says, I lost my place. I forgot what he said next. You know, he said, schmuck. Look at the last one. This is just a beautiful one. Torah was given to Israel by a great voice that did not cease. It has never stopped. Remember the question? How come God talks to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and doesn't talk to us? Why did God talk to the people of Mount Sinai and God doesn't do that again? Here's the Rebbe's answer. The voice never ceased. It's not that God showed up on Mount Sinai one afternoon 3,800 years ago and started talking to the Jews and then stopped. Mount Sinai is a broadcast tower. God has been broadcasting, WGOD, God has been broadcasting truth from the beacon of Mount Sinai every day since the world was created. What happened on that day at Mount Sinai with the Jewish people? It was the only time in all Jewish history that the whole Jewish people showed up and shut up. And literally, it was the only time that the whole Jewish people could be quiet enough to listen. That's what happened at that moment. But other than that, God keeps broadcasting. And the question of life is, Shema Yisrael, can you hear it? Can you listen? Can you hear it? Each day when we say Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, there is a voice answering, I am the Lord your God. I'm right here. We say Shema Yisrael, God says, listen, I'm right here, I'm talking to you. The voice has never stopped. The voice has never stopped. I'll give you a good analogy to this. Anyone know what the Doppler effect is? Anyone know how they discovered the Big Bang? Anybody know what the redshift is? Anyone study astronomy here? Alright, what happened? They invented radio telescopes sometime in the 1950s. Radio telescope detects radiation. Not visible light, but invisible radiation in the universe, right? They took these radio telescopes and they beamed them into the sky. And guess what they discovered? Everything is red. What do you mean red? When objects move away from each other, you have a shift to a different, to the lower end of the frequency scale, so it's red. In other words, when they pointed it into the sky, they found that everything in the universe is still resonating from the Big Bang. Every molecule in the universe is still resonating from the Big Bang. You, me, everything. We're all part of the Big Bang, some billions of years ago, and we're still resonating from that explosion.
Messages from water. Messages from water.
Yeah.
The Japanese philosopher says that you take the water and it will have the effect, the ions will have the effect of negative words or values.
It's all in there. Every human being's genome contains the entire genetic history of the species. Every one of us carries the entire genetic history of the human race. The Rebbe's idea is the world still resonates with God's words, let there be. So that the world is suffused with divinity. The world is filled with divinity. It's a question of how do you access that information. The voice has never stopped. But we have to prepare ourselves to truly hear the Shema without any distracting thoughts. The reason why we can't hear God's voice in the world is not because God isn't speaking loudly enough, it's because we're always distracted. Because there's so many things distracting you. Because there's so many internal thoughts and so much ego and so many desires and so many itchy noses and so many moody kids and so many sore bellies and so many ruined knees and so many things going on that you never have the time to really stop and listen. If you could listen, you could hear God all the time. Religion is a way of practicing that kind of listening. Religion is a way of learning that. By the way, that's why you put a mezuzah on the door. If you ever want to know what a mezuzah is for, it's really very simple. What's the first word in a mezuzah? In a mezuzah, there's a little cloth, right? There's a little parchment. You all knew that, right? Please tell me your mezuzahs have a parchment in it. If your mezuzah on your door doesn't have a parchment, do you know what you have? A box. What do you call a boomerang that doesn't come back? A stick. What do you call a mezuzah without a piece of parchment? A box, right? On that little piece of parchment is written the words of the Shema. The first word of the Shema is the word Shema. Right below it is written the word Ve'ahavta. Listen and love. When you come to your house, stop at the door, touch the mezuzah, and say to yourself, the people who live in my house are the most important people I'm going to be with today. I'm going to learn to listen to them. It will change your life. I'm going to learn to listen to them. Come, kiss the mezuzah, come inside. If you forget everything else, the first letter in the mezuzah, it's often written on the outside of the mezuzah, is a shin. What's the sound of a shin in Hebrew? Does that tell you something? This is a crazy idea, which we never think about. Being Jewish is about learning how to listen. No, you're right. Being Jewish is about talking. We talk a lot. We eat a lot. No. Being Jewish is learning how to listen. The wisdom hidden within creation since its beginning can be discovered only with the power of Torah. Torah is a tool for accessing the resonance of God within the world as we live in. By the labors of Torah, one can raise up this beginning that is found within nature. This is the work, to find words of Torah everywhere. That is, everything, every moment you're in the world, every person you meet, every object you come into contact with has been sent to you by God to teach you something. A Jew must have faith that everything is in Torah, that the power of God's 10 utterances are hidden within nature. This is what's truly meant by redemption or freedom, bringing the precious forth from the ordinary. Jewish peoples are instruments for this. These are big chauvinists. When they came out of Egypt, this purification was performed for them for the entire world. So the transformed 10 utterances of creation became the 10 commandments. All right, here's the drasha, here's the table game, here's the last thing we're going to do. Ready? In the book of Genesis, God creates the world. 10 times God says, Vayehi, let there be. There are 10 words of creation. Translation. God put 10 measures of godly love into the world. 10 measures of creativity. 10 measures of godly care and concern into the world. And then turn the keys of the world over to us. There you go. Run my world. What did we do with it? We ran it into the ground. One by one, we ruined God's world. One by one, we took each of the 10 measures of divine creativity and we buried them. For example, God taught us that every human being is created in the divine image and thereby possesses infinite preciousness. What did we do? We manipulate people. We use people. We destroy people. We enslave people. God taught us about light, that light is a gift to us. What do? We turn the world into a place of darkness. When you take the last of the 10 measures, all 10 measures of divine love, divine concern, and divine care, and you bury them in the ground, you suppress them, you create a world which is absent of divinity. The name of a world absent of divinity in Hebrew is Egypt. Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim, Egypt, is the name of a place in which there is none of the 10 measures of divine divinity left. How do you know? Because that's what the 10 plagues were. According to this Midrash, the 10 plagues were not punishments cast down on high. The 10 plagues were the natural consequences of creating the society in which you have willfully suppressed divine blessing. If you create a society in which human beings are enslaved, they are turned into physical objects. They are completely robbed of their humanity and their dignity, in which life becomes that cheap. A river of red blood runs down your main street. That's what the 10 plagues are. They are the natural consequences of having suppressed divine love in the world. 10 words of utterances yield us, you suppress all 10 of them, you get 10 plagues. We were liberated from there. God pulled us out of there. And God said, you have a choice. You have an opportunity. You have a job. Here's your job. You have to go and unearth my measures of love. You have to bring them back to life in my world. I won't do it for you. I won't do it for you. You're going to have to do it. You have to bring the measures of divine love back into the world again. I won't do it for you, but this is what I will do. I'll give you 10 tools. I'll give you 10 tools for returning divine love to the world. Returning plagues into blessings. That's the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are the 10 tools for turning the 10 plagues back into 10 measures of divine love. That's the story. So, while you're sitting at your Seder table, waiting for your brother-in-law to finish the damn Seder, play the following table game. Match up 10 commandments, 10 plagues, 10 creative acts. I'll give you the first one free. Okay? Give you the first one free. God says, let us create man in our image, in our likeness. Human beings are created in God's likeness, right? We suppress that in the world. Which of the 10 plagues represents the utter suppression of divine special uniqueness, of human special uniqueness? The death of the firstborn. You create a society in which you ultimately end up killing your own children. A society that values life so little, that enhances murder, that worships violence, that engages in violence as entertainment, ends up killing its own children. Which of the Ten Commandments puts it back into the world? Pick one.
Yeah.
Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill. Meaning, bring life back into my world and embrace life as precious. Okay? All right, got one. Now I got 9 more. Let's try another one, shall we? How about this one? Let's go the other way. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Bill Clinton's favorite. What is adultery? Adultery is when you take sexuality, all of the power and energy of sexuality, and you release it from the bottle of marriage and responsible relationship. Which plague is when you take something that belongs in one place where it's controlled and you release it and it ends up everywhere? Frogs here, frogs there, jumping froggies everywhere. Frogs also the Egyptian god of fertility. What does frogs represent then? Frogs represents what happens when you make pornography your culture. Frogs represent what happens when you take the holiness of sexuality and you let it loose on the landscape. so that every place you turn is sexual innuendo, sexual suggestiveness, and there is no modesty or holiness or intimacy associated with sexuality. Which of the 10 acts of creation involves putting what should be in one place, and keeping what should be someplace else in another place? The firmament between dry land and earth. You see? That's two. Only 8 more to go. Pick another one. Have some fun. Thou shalt not steal. Okay? Which plague represents thou shalt not steal? Have some fun with this. The 10 plagues represent what we do to a world when we suppress divine blessings. The 10 commandments are what we do to unearth those divine blessings. The philosophy that the Rebbe offers us is a powerful philosophy that says it is the responsibility of human beings to make sure that the world that they live in is not turned into Egypt. Whether you live in a place which is paradise, or whether you live in a place which is Egypt, is entirely in your hands. You have to decide, and you have to make that determination, and you have to fight for that. And that is what the entire Torah tradition is trying to teach you how to do. That's what the Torah tradition teaches how to do. The Hasidic tradition was a moment of discontinuity when the Jewish people felt depressed and felt rejected and felt pushed out. And this tradition gave us back a sense of our efficacy and a sense of our closeness to God.
Yeah. And I can imagine when Moses looked down and saw the golden calf, and he saw that the people of the land were indeed embracing something called God's calf, which was a representation of this very thing we're talking about.
Right.
That he saw them dancing around this goddess, the cat, that they were in fact embracing all of the 10 plagues that represents the Egyptian ethos.
And then what did he do?
He raised hell, because you know what he...
Yeah, but here's what's interesting. I said this last night. Here's what's interesting to me about that story. If it were me, I'd have gone back up the mountain.
And?
If it were me, if I were Moses, I would have said, you know, this people's hopeless. This people's hopeless. No, he didn't. If it were me, I would have gone back up the mountain. I said, God, I'm living with you. I ain't going back down there. I'm not living with these people. You can have them. Send them anywhere you want. They're your problem, they're not my problem anymore. I'm going to come live up here. Right? In Buddhism, there's a wonderful problem of what happens when the Buddha, the guy who's been meditating, reaches Buddha consciousness. The question is, how does he come back down again? Moses doesn't do that. He gets angry, that's true, because he has a problem with anger control, no question. Big problem. But he goes back and confronts his people. And that's exactly the point I tried to make these 2 days. The reason he confronts his people is because he believes in the capacity of his people to be reborn. The reason he confronts his people is he doesn't give up on them. He believes in the resilience of his people to find the spiritual resources to turn in a different direction and embrace in a new way a divine dream of what they can be. He doesn't go back and simply satisfy his own spiritual longings. He goes back to his people to become the leader and to lead them to the promised land. And he doesn't give up no matter how many times they disappoint him and betray him and rebel against him and piss him off. He keeps coming back and taking them in the direction they need to go. I'm going to suggest to you that we are living through one of these moments. And there is a huge temptation to just go back up the hill and say to hell, I'll go live with God. I'll go do my own spiritual thing. But this people has this remarkable capacity to reinvent itself. And if you understand that capacity from the history of this people and can witness its capacity to creatively reinvent itself, its capacity to find new truth, its capacity to reorient its institutions and reinvent its institutions and to reinterpret its sense of mission in the world. If you understand the creative capacity of that, then you too will come down the mountain, mad as hell, but come down the mountain and lead them in the right direction. And the reason I've been coming back to Ace Chaim for 10 years is because I think you people, in all of your craziness, and God knows, right? In all of your insanity, and God knows, that you people are part of that, a very, very important part of that process. We live in a time of Jewish continuity. A time of Jewish continuity is a time of Jewish creativity and Jewish reinvention. And there's something deeply exciting about that. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.